Today, just how low will interest rates go? The Property Imperative Weekly to the 8th of June 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics with our latest digest of finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And once again, we are drowning in both new data and big picture issues which will shake the finance and property markets. But don't fear, I'll be your guide through the past week, in which locally the GDP was weak, rates were cut, more rate cuts are expected, and internationally the US-China trade dispute took an interesting turn while stock markets surged on the prospect of more central bank support. This week, we'll start with the international scene before later looking more closely at the Australian situation, not least because being a trade-exposed open economy, locally, we are heavily influenced by what is happening offshore. Wall Street's major indices charged higher on Friday. A sharply slowing US job growth boosted hopes for Federal Reserve interest rate cuts, while optimism about potential progress in US trade fights with China and Mexico added to risk appetites. The major averages finished with the biggest one-day gain since November, with the S&P 500 up 4.5% and the Nasdaq up 4% and the Dow up 4.8%. The S&P 500 ended the week down 2.6% from its April peak. The Nasdaq is still off 5.22% from its April high, and the Dow is still off 3.48% from its October 18 high. The rally, which was pushed along by heavy computerized trading, was fueled by bad news as investors bet that labor market weakness would give the Fed a reason to provide the economy with more support. A Labor Department report showed non-farm payrolls increased by 74,000 jobs last month, much smaller than the 185,000 additions estimated by economists, suggesting the loss of momentum in economic activity was spreading to the labor market in the US. As a result, traders raised bets for a rate cut in July, followed by two more rate cuts by the year end. But others noted that investors appeared to give more weight to Fed policy than economic data. We're addicted to low rates, and we're willing to forsake our economic growth in exchange for those low rates, as one analyst put it. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1.02% on Friday to 25,983. The S&P 500 gained 1.05% to 2,873, and the Nasdaq composite was up 1.66% to 7,742. So, adding to investor enthusiasm on Friday was a notice from US officials granting Chinese exporters two more weeks to get their products to the United States before raising tariffs on those items. And the US and Chinese leaders are expected to meet later in June at the G20 meeting. But while US President Donald Trump said that there was a good chance of a US-Mexico trade deal if the two countries failed to make an agreement, he plans to impose a 5% tariff on Mexican imports on Monday. Minutes before Trump spoke, Fitch cut its sovereign rating for Mexico to BBB from BBB+, while Moody's cut its outlook to negative from stable. Behind the scenes, it seems that negotiators are battling to reach agreement over a US demand that Mexico accept more asylum seekers. A tariff on Mexico hurts Trump, as like all tariffs, it is a tax that the buyer pays, and it could also lead to Congress overruling the president on his use of emergency powers and taking back some trade authority. And in fact, while lower interest rates might help superficially, reaching agreement on the trade wars would be better. Technology stocks were amongst the hardest hit due to the recent escalation in trade tensions. They only rose 2% and provide the biggest boost of the S&P 500's 11 major sectors. The S&P 500 financials was up 0.37% to 449, despite including a range of interest rate sensitive stocks, and Goldman Sachs was flat at 189.81. The 10-year US bond stood at 2.08, down 0.02% on Friday, while the three-month rate was 2.277, down 0.13%, so the yield curve inversion remains clearly visible, signalling recession ahead. The volatility index was up 2.32% to 1630. Gold futures rose 0.16% to 133.44. Little changed over the past year, in fact, despite the recent run-up, while crude oil for delivery in July rose 2.78% to 54.05 a barrel. The euro-US dollar was up 0.52% to 1.1333, while the yuan-US dollar was flat at 0.1447. The US dollar index futures was down 0.48% to 96.53. The euro rallied significantly during the week, breaking out against the downtrend and reaching higher as the US dollar has been on the back foot for the last few days. The European Central Bank said that it would delay its first post-crisis interest rate hike until at least the middle of next year, in a move that was well flagged. The ECB president, Mario Draghi, also offered to pay banks if they borrow cash from the central bank and pass it on to households and firms. Trade tensions and fears of a global recession have put markets in a state of flux this week, with market participants increasingly hopeful that ECB president Mario Draghi would signal a late burst of monetary support before his term ends in October. The central bank said that interest rates on its margin lending facility and deposit facility would remain changed at 0%, 0.25% and minus 0.4% respectively. These have been at record lows following the euro sovereign debt crisis of 2011 in an effort to boost inflation and stimulate growth. In a surprise revision to its forward guidance, the ECB said that the Governing Council now expects the key ECB interest rates to remain at their present levels at least through to the first half of 2020. The prolonged presence of uncertainties relating to geopolitical factors, the rising threat of protectionism and vulnerabilities in emerging markets is leaving its mark on economic sentiment, Draghi said. And meanwhile, Draghi also presented a fresh round of forecasts for economic growth as well as inflation. According to the forecasts, the ECB sees GDP growth of 1.2% in 2019 up a whole 0.1 percentage point from its previous forecast in March. For 2020, the ECB forecasts the economy to grow at 1.4%, down 0.2 percentage points as compared to its previous forecast. And the ECB slightly raised its inflation forecasts for 2019 to 1.3%, up 0.1 percentage points from its previous forecast in March. Meanwhile, for 2020, the ECB revised its forecast to 1.4%, down 0.1 percentage point from its earlier forecast in March. There is no probability of deflation. There is very low probability of recession. There are no threats of de-anchoring of inflation expectations, Draghi said. Now, in April, Draghi said policymakers at the ECB would look at how monetary policy is working when setting the terms for its new cheap loan program for banks, the TLTROS, Targeted Long-Term Refinancing Operations. Essentially, these loans should make the Eurozone's banks lend more to the real economy. They have a negative deposit rate, so they would pay lenders for taking the cash, meaning it's a strong incentive for the banks to use them. The rate in each TLTRO operation will be 10 basis points above the average rate applied in main refinancing operations over the life of the respective facilities, and as low as the average deposit facility rate plus 10 basis points for banks exceeding a certain lending benchmark, Draghi said on Thursday. And it's important to understand the effect of negative rate policy. Pantheon macroeconomic analyst Klaus Wisten showed in a recent paper that the increase in the Eurozone household net worth is now exclusively driven by rising house prices. The yields on two-year bonds plotted against house prices increases in the Eurozone shows the curves move in a similar direction, suggesting that as yields trended towards negative territory, the higher house prices climbed. As yields on two-year bonds have gone into negative territory, house prices in Europe have gone up. And this chart shows a much closer relationship between declining bond yields and declining interest rates on mortgages. As yields on two-year bonds have declined, so have mortgage rates for home buyers in Europe. The conclusion is that the cheaper you make mortgages via negative interest rates for banks, the more house prices go up, as the supply of buyers enjoying easy cash increases. With negative rates expected to stay in place until at least 2021, households are enjoying the wealth increase that rising property prices brings. This, Visten says, is why bad economic news, recessions in Italy, a collapse in Germany's manufacturing sector, never seem to faze happy European consumers. Brexit, Italian budget squabbles, trade wars, and rising uncertainty in the Middle East are all at the forefront of households' minds when quizzed about the economy as a whole, Visten wrote. The Commission's sub-index for the general economic situation in the next 12 months plunged to a five-year low in April, but consumers' expectation for their own financial situation is steady and strong. The resilience in these expectations very likely is a close function of rising house prices. One more reason why we expect the RBA to go negative eventually. And meanwhile, India's central bank cut its benchmark interest rate for the third time this year on Thursday, and expectations are building that the Bank of Japan could also add additional stimulus soon. Spot the common themes: lower interest rates, lower growth, lower inflation, and central bank stimulus. And in that context, so to Australia. The latest GDP figures, as Greg Jericho, linked below to his full article, put it, has put beyond doubt that the Turnbull-Morrison government's management of the economy has been completely incompetent. The economy is barely growing, and for the first time in 36 years, GDP per capita has gone backwards in three consecutive quarters. The government has in reality run the economy into the ground. Those following the DFA analysis will already, of course, know this. In seasonally adjusted terms, the economy grew by just 1.8% in the past 12 months, and it was a mere 1.7% in the less erratic trend terms. Either way, it is the slowest growth since 2009. The quarterly trend growth of 0.26% is the slowest quarter of growth since March 2003, and the annual growth of GDP per capita of just 0.09% is the worst for a decade. In seasonally adjusted terms, GDP per capita fell 0.03%, which after falls in December and September quarters last year marks the first time that's happened since June 1983. Now, sure, quarterly growth figures can bounce around, but it is hard to spin that as being a sign of strength in the economy. What growth there was came from government spending, both in infrastructure and areas such as the NDIS. If we took away government consumption and investment in the March quarter, GDP would have fallen 0.05% in trend terms. And the construction sector also remains very weak. Dwelling construction fell in the March quarter, and both it and non-dwelling construction fell over the past year. And over the past year, government consumption and investment contributed 1.4 points towards total GDP growth, 1.7%. That effectively means government spending accounted for, wait for it, 79% of GDP growth in the past year, a level only marginally below what happened during the massive stimulus years of the GFC. It points to an incredible weak private sector. Despite the fact that company profit grew 9.8% in the past year, the strongest growth for nearly 2 years. But of course, the disconnect between company profits and household incomes continues. Over the past 3 years, company profits have grown on average by 10.1%, well above the 4.3% growth in compensation of employees, a level that is actually falling. The lack of household disposable income is brought into very sharp relief when looking at the growth of household consumption. The annual growth of 1.7% is the worst for 6 years and is more than half the long-term average of 3.5%. It's no surprise to anyone that this is happening. Living in the real world, unpopulated by political spin, we know that the economy is faltering and that employment wages are barely keeping up with inflation. In the past year, the average compensation of employees grew just 1.5%. Because inflation in that period grew by a pathetic 1.3%, it means that average consumption grew in real terms. But even with the slight increase, it still sees real compensation per employee 1.6% below the level it was when the LNP took office in 2009. in 2013. A similar story occurs for household living standards, where despite a slight increase, households still have less disposable income in real terms than they did at the end of 2010. And the story is even worse when we look at productivity, which over the past 3 years has averaged lower growth than any time since the 1990s recession. It seems almost impossible to get productivity growth lower than what occurred during the miserable work choice years, but that is what has now occurred. And the final big picture scenario reveals just how terrible things are now. Given the average GDP growth target is between 2.75% and 3.25%, that combined with the RBA inflation growth target of 2% and 3% gives us an economic sweet spot of 4.75% and 6.25% in what is called the adjusted nominal GDP. Right now, the level is the lowest it has been since the 1990s recession, equal with a point reached during the GFC. And so he concludes, this is a shocking state of affairs, and it makes an absolute mockery of the government's claims of economic management expertise. It also renders absurd desires to get back to a surplus in order to build a buffer should bad times come, because bad times are already here. And we agree. Hi, excuse the interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now back to the current show. No wonder the RBA cut the cash rate last Tuesday and are desperately trying to stimulate housing to reverse the collapse. But we think the chances of success are limited. The RBA cut by 25 basis points, the first move for nearly 3 years. And remember that just 3 months ago, the RBA was suggesting the next move would be higher. They do not appear to have their finger on the pulse, and I'll discuss this with economist John Adams in our post, The Economic Emperor of Australia Will Crush You. The Big Four all announced cuts in their variable mortgage rates. Around 75% of borrowers, of course, are on variable rates, but the amount of the cuts and the timing does vary between banks. Both the RBA governor and the treasurer on the record said that banks should pass through the full cuts, and that borrowers should shop around and demand a better rate, which of course is always good advice. And the funding position of the banks, as represented by the BBSW, is also supportive of a pass-through. Analysts were expecting around half to pass through, which would be neutral to profits. Thus, those who pass through more will see their margins compressed. And it is certain that they will cut deposit rates to alleviate this to some extent. It's funny how deposit rate cuts are hardly ever reported and never make the headlines. And as a rule of thumb, a 5 basis point net margin reduction translates to a 1% fall in bank profit. One problem is that many call deposits are close to zero now, so expect a bigger trimming of term deposit rates. And we also expect some savers to pull funds from deposits to try other investments with a higher return, though with higher risks. This is how the majors came out. ANZ decreased their variable mortgage rate by 18 basis points, which is 7 basis points lower than the RBA 25 basis point cash rate, and this will be effective from the 14th of June. CBA decreased their Australian variable rate by 25 basis points, and this will be effective from the 25th of June. Given their better systems, this is a deliberate delay, in my view, to protect profits. NAB decreased their Australian variable rate by 25 basis points and will be effective from the 14th of June. And Westpac reduced their Australian mortgage rate by 20 basis points, though its investor interest-only home loan rates will reduce by 35 basis points. And this will be effective from the 18th of June. Generally, investment mortgages are now carry a higher mortgage rate than owner-occupied lending, of course. Regionals and smaller players already have margin pressures and competitive disadvantage to cope with, yet they will have to keep their rates in line with the market to maintain new and existing business flows. We're entering a diabolical phase in our interest rate history, and this signals ongoing economic weakness. Now, most economists are predicting more cuts ahead. Indeed, the governor said as much in his speech this week. The governor has pointed to an ambitious objective for the labour market, with an unemployment rate of 4.5% seen as necessary to bring inflation back to target. This is despite his own forecast indicating a 5% result on the basis of two rate cuts. That challenge can certainly be interpreted as an expectation of the need to deliver more than just two rate cuts. So Westpac says data supports our view of the need for August and November cash rate cuts following the June decision. And they also think that the FOMC will act in September and December. And ANZ says that the Aussie will fall against the US dollar. The RBA has begun a fresh easing cycle, and we now expect the Fed to follow suit despite respectable levels of growth in the US. We expect that the Aussie dollar rates will outperform and the Australian rate structure will remain below the US for the foreseeable future. Of course, there are consequences of cutting rates. First, savers who have already been taken to the cleaners over the past couple of years with out-of-cycle cuts will once again see their returns fall further. Experience from the UK shows, for example, many deposit accounts slide close to zero, like 0.01%. Even term deposits will fall. And this will clip household consumption for those reliant on income from deposits to pay the bills. Second, as the AFR pointed out, at the end of a huge week for the four banks, it's time for those reliant on dividend income to think hard about the longer-term implications of official interest rates being lower for longer. There is no need to panic, they say, but as official rates set by the Reserve Bank of Australia move to 1% and possibly 0.75% next year, over the next 6 months there will be enormous downward pressure on bank profitability. Too right. Bank dividends will suffer whatever happens to credit growth. Many will switch to lower rate loans, and so the banks will see their margins under pressure while there is a limit to how low deposit rates can go. Some households who hold deposits also rely on bank dividends, so this is a second strike on their cash flow. And Chris Joy in the AFR said it makes no sense for the RBA to crush the bank's net interest margin through rate cuts and expect them to comfortably lower lending rates. Limited pass-through means the RBA is going to be inevitably forced to think about a third cut. This is why the central bank will presumably be considering some form of complementary quantitative easing to maximize pass-through, ideally before the next cut. And in fact, the RBA announced that they have set the scene for more QE. Following a review, the Reserve Bank has assessed the authorised depository taking institutions, ADIs, using the Committed Liquidity Facility, the CLF, and can increase their holdings of high-quality liquid assets from 25 to 30% of the stock of HQLA securities. This change is possible because the volume of HQLA securities has risen over recent years. To minimize the effect on market functioning, the increase will occur at a base of 1 percentage point per year until 2024, commencing with an increase to 26% in 2020. As an alternative to holding HQLA to meet the LCR, ADIs can apply to APRA to establish a committed liquidity facility with the Reserve Bank. This enables them to access a set amount of liquidity from the Reserve Bank under repo against eligible securities as collateral. These ADIs are required to meet several conditions, including paying the CLF fee. Now, this sets up the RBA's ability to buy securitized assets from the banks, and that's classic QE behavior. And APRA gave an astonishing written response to Senator Peter Whish Wilson's question about average mortgage sizes during the recent budget estimates. The reply from APRA is that they take the loan account data provided by the banks and calculate the aggregate balance of all housing loans, gross of offsets and provisions, divided by the number of loans. So nothing about total household debt exposures, nothing about loan splitting across multiple properties or banks, nor the split between fixed interest and variable interest loans. So they report a meaningless score, which provides little insight into the dynamics of bank loan portfolios, which conveniently avoids the real question, which is, how in debt real households are. This is more evidence of APRA's myopic approach, scorekeeper for the banks, not proactive regulator. A quick word on the latest credit flow data from the ABS. As we highlighted yesterday, see pre-election housing finance is weaker than expected, the April credit flow stats were pretty weak, weaker than expected, suggesting that the hoped-for auction clearance boom has yet to translate into anything credible in terms of credit growth. More noise by the pro-house boom lobby, not exhibited in the data. And across the segments, we see a slight lift from first-time buyers, looking at the trends over more than a decade, though still down 7% from peak. Upgraders are down 21% from peak. Investors are down 48% from peak. And foreign buyers have all but disappeared, down more than 80%. So tell me again, how will home prices recover? And remember, households are still struggling with their finances. We released our latest mortgage stress research to the end of May 2019. And across Australia, more than 1,071,000 households are estimated now to be in mortgage stress, compared with 1,050,000 last month. That's another record. And this equates to more than 31.9% of owner-occupied borrowing households. In addition, more than 33,000, compared with 30,000 last month, of these are now in severe stress. And we estimate that more than 70,500 are now in risk of 30-day default in the next 12 months. And this is as the impact of flat wages growth, rising living costs, and some higher real mortgage rates still hit home. Bank losses are likely to rise a little. See more in our post, mortgage stress is rising post the election. Incomes are flat, costs are rising, and more households are being offered bigger mortgages. This will not end well. Home prices continue to drift lower in most cities, according to the CoreLogix Daily Index. Prices in Sydney dropped 0.07% over the last week. They're down 1.91% over the quarter. They've dropped 10.7% over the last year, and they're down 15% from their recent peak. Melbourne is down 0.06% over the last week, down 1.52% over the last quarter, down 10% over the last year, and down 11.2% from their peak. Brisbane is down 0.11% over the last week, is down 0.14% over the quarter, is down 2.5% over the last year, and is down 2.2% from the last peak. Adelaide is up 0.07% over the last week, but is down 0.26% over the last quarter, was up 0.1% over the last year, and is down 0.6% from the last peak. Perth is down 0.18% over the last week, down 1.87% over the last quarter, down 8.9% over the last year, and down 19.4% over the last peak. And the five majors combined are down 0.08% over the last week, down 1.67% over the last quarter, down 8.8% over the last year, and 10.8% down from the last peak. And we can also look at the movements on an annual basis. And we can see there that Sydney continues to grind a little lower, along with Melbourne, both more than 10% over the last year, and relatively consistent falls over the period, particularly over the last 6 months. We see that in Brisbane, prices are continuing to slide further, and I think the rate of fall is increasing a little. In Adelaide, there is a little bit more upside, but still hardly any movement in real terms. Perth, of course, continues to fall, and the rate of decline there has accelerated again. And so the average five-city rate is also lower. Now, of course, it will be interesting to see whether post the election the trajectory changes. But at the moment, it's pretty clear that gravity is still very much in force. And auction clearance rates were reported higher at 58%, with Sydney and Melbourne both over 60% higher than for some time. But again, we need to be careful because of the number of auctions. They're still very low. Of the 1,661 listed auctions, 811 were reported cleared. And quickly to the local markets. The ASX 100 rose 0.94% on Friday to end at 5,329. The ASX Financials rose 0.77% to end at 6,228. The local volatility index was down 6.39% on Friday to end at 1336. ANZ Banking Group was up 0.75% to 2837. Commonwealth Bank was up 0.35% at $80. National Australia Bank was up 0.56% to 2690. And Westpac was up 0.54% to 2798. The Bank of Queensland was up 0.74% to end at 9.51, having announced their new CEO. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank was up 0.7% to 11.50, and Suncorp was up 0.84% to end at 13.20. Macquarie Group was up 1.67% to 119.21. The AMP was up 0.95% to 2.13, and Genworth Mortgage Insurance was up 1.12% to 271. McGrath was down 1.72% to 28.5 cents. And Yellowbit Road Holdings was up 6.67% to 8 cents. Mortgage Choice was up 1.46% to 1.218. The Aussie US dollar was up 0.34% to end at 70 cents dead. So it's recovered a little bit from last week. The spot gold Aussie Cross was up 0.06% on Friday to 1,915, and it's 13.03% compared with last year and is as high as it's been. And the Bitcoin Aussie Dollar Cross was at 10,034, which is just 0.81% higher than last year. Finally, two important endnotes. First, if you are concerned about bank deposit bail-in in Australia, where, in a crisis, the regulators can grab and convert bank deposits into bank shares to keep a bank afloat in a crisis, you need to watch the show I recorded with Robbie Barwick from the CEC called Bail-In Mark II. More importantly, there is a petition to get the government to remove deposit bail-in from the table. And so please consider signing it. You can do so online. Here is the link, and it's also in the comments below. And secondly, mark your diary. Our next live Q&A event is scheduled for Tuesday, the 18th of June at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You can ask questions live via the chat or beforehand via the DFA blog. Links to the blog is below. I look forward to seeing you on the night. Frankly, given the global and local uncertainty, it is more important than ever to stay informed and be alert to the possible implications of low interest rates and QE, etc. So the role of DFA has become ever more important in providing objective and independent information for you. In uncertain times such as these, be informed and prepared. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.